What makes for a smooth succession transition at a private equity firm? What are the advantages and disadvantages of different routes, be it an IPO, a GP stake, or management company financing? And what can be done to align the interests of team members, LPs, and other stakeholders as the firm continues to grow? We'll be discussing these topics and more with a guest interview from John Harvey, Head of Relationship Management at Investec Fund Solutions, in today's episode of the Unquote Private Equity Podcast. Hello, listener, and welcome to this new episode of the Unquote Private Equity Podcast by Merger Market. My name's Harriet Matthews. I'm funds editor at Merger Market, and I'll be your host for today. Now, private equity often claims to offer a succession solution to the portfolio companies that it acquires, allowing founders or owners to take advantage of fresh capital, either for growth or to cash out, and to ensure the future of their business. What is talked about less is how private equity firms themselves manage their own succession issues. We've seen prominent examples of how challenging this can be and how it needs to be mastered, often in the public eye, from firms including Carlyle and Ardian. And succession is an issue that does come up again and again in conversations around CVC's IPO and more generally proposed IPOs of private equity firms. Plus, just about every long-standing mid-market private equity firm has had to contend with this type of generational change, albeit usually under less scrutiny than their large cap peers. So later in this episode, I'll be joined by John Harvey from the Fund Solutions team at banking, financial services and advisory firm Investec to discuss some of the routes that GPs can take to manage succession and liquidity. But to set the scene before that, I'm joined by Rachel Lewis, senior private equity reporter at Merger Market. Rachel, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Harriet, and hello to everyone at home.
Now, as I've said, this topic seems to be coming up quite a lot at the moment, so I'm looking forward to talking about it. Can you run through some recent examples, Rachel, of where we've seen this as a feature?
Sure, and I just want to start off by saying that succession really does feel like a much more prominent issue than it did a couple of years ago. Just very recently, we saw external media reports that were pointing to Bridgepoint looking externally via a recruitment company to start looking for a new chairman to replace William Jackson. I will add in there that Bridgepoint's set of search is not currently underway. But again, I think it just leads to questions. Why isn't Bridgepoint looking internally for that role? A chairman is a very different role to a CEO. It typically has been someone who has been the CEO or has at least sat on the board and knows the company inside out. So Bridgepoint is one that's happened very recently. And then I also wanted to talk about Cinven as well.
Yes, those are all good questions regarding Bridgepoint and obviously quite a kind of public example in terms of the reporting there. We also saw Cinven make an official announcement around some kind of team changes, laying out plans for its succession. What did that look like, Rachel?
Now, I think this is very interesting from a culture and brand perspective, because what Cinven has actually done is hand over control of the company from a management perspective to three co-managing partners. So within this, one of them will chair the portfolio review committee, another will chair the investment committee, and the third will manage the day-to-day operations as CEO and chair of the executive committee. This is very different, I think, to how we've seen a lot of GPs manage this plan. And I think it's interesting from a culture perspective, because it's now three people who can focus on one task instead of three. And it can be great to hear more voices in the room, although, you know, that's something that could also be difficult with too many voices. So I'll be interested to see what happens with Cinven and how that's managed going forward. But I think putting that job on three people instead of one does many things. More voices, it reduces the key man risk, and I think it's a really interesting way to manage succession.
Definitely. And we don't know quite what's going on behind the scenes there in terms of any solutions Cinven might be turning to around kind of ownership or liquidity of the firm. But we're going to be discussing some of those topics in our guest interview now with John Harvey from the Fund Solutions team at Investec. Just for a bit of background, John joined the firm in 2007 and he has experience with its structured property finance teams, specialised lending, and of course now the Fund Solutions team. So we'll take a listen to that interview, and then Rachel and I will be back with you after that. Hello, John, and welcome to the Unquote Private Equity podcast by Merger Market.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you, and I'm really excited to talk about this topic today, actually, because it seems to be becoming kind of more and more interesting and pertinent, I think. Succession and the value created at private equity firms themselves is just becoming more widely talked about, I'd say, over the last few years. And I'd be curious to hear if you've had a sense of that as well and what you think the triggers for that are.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's a topic which has been around for a few years now. It hasn't really gone away. And I think, you know, if you look at some of the underlying factors around that, you know, PE is still, you know, a relatively young industry. And a lot of the firms, particularly in the mid-market, are still driven by very much a founder-led culture. We've obviously seen a huge growth in alternatives and people investing into alternatives over the last few years, and mainly into PE, which, you know, has accelerated the value that can be created in a management company as funds have got bigger and management fees have so on increased. So people, I think, are conscious of this. Certainly investors are. They're looking for people that, you know, to be able to create a long-term brand and not rely on individual sort of rainmakers in terms of getting deals done and so on. But equally, particularly in the mid-market, I think there's a sense of, well, from a founder, you know, we've created a lot of value here, and how do we really extract some of that value? Which can be done in a number of ways, but I guess it's pretty much a sign of an industry maturing, really. If you look probably at the large cap funds, you know, you see EQT in the press this week with a large fundraise. Yeah, they've exposed themselves to the public markets over a number of years now and have dealt with succession, you know, in good and bad ways, but mainly have used the public markets to expand their growth. Those public markets until probably recently, just before pre-COVID, were, you know, not really suited for mid-market firms. You know, so trying to create or extract some value from the firm in terms of the management company was, you know, fairly limited in some of the options that you could take out at the time. What we saw, just after COVID or just before, is increasingly the mid-market looking at options in terms of, you know, what can we do here to extract some value? We obviously saw some of the mid-market firms look at an IPO. And obviously that set off a chain of events of pretty much every other private equity firm out there thinking, wow, we're worth a lot of money if I look at that price. More increasingly, some of these public market options have become available to the mid-market. There's also, you know, we've seen an increase in the last 5 years of sovereign wealth funds or, you know, direct investment funds taking an actual stake in a management company. Again, this can be used to take some cash out from the value that's been created, or it can be used for growth options. The other bit that we're a bit closer to being a bank is just actual financing of, you know, providing some debt to the management company. And why this is important is that if you keep a good balance of debt and equity, the buy-in into the equity for the more junior partners remains at a more steady level. Yeah, and where we've seen this come out of kilter is as funds have grown and management fees have grown and value of the management company's grown. And, you know, the buy-in is very, very difficult unless you were one of the founding partners.
Yeah, definitely. So there's a few kind of different options that seem to be kind of rising in prominence. Obviously, you've mentioned IPOs, the general kind of management company financing from the debt side. And there's the whole kind of GP stakes universe as well, with specialized managers, people like Hunter Point Capital. And in the UK, that's obviously been relevant for managers like Inflection and Collar Capital and MML, just to name a few that kind of came through last year. I wanted to ask you, John, a bit about some of those options and kind of how they, you know, how prevalent they are and sort of what some of the maybe pitfalls or advantages to them are. Because as you say, people are looking to kind of, you know, potentially in some cases take money off the table, but also continue their own firm and kind of legacy. How can some of these options affect succession and affect culture?
Yeah, I mean, all of them have got different pros and cons to them. And, you know, I think the transition is something, and particularly as you mentioned, culture is something that you have to be aware of when you look at all of these different options. I think the debt option that we're a little bit closer to is a little bit more manageable, but it doesn't create the big cash event in one hit. You know, you'd have to do it over a number of years. As you increase your fundraising and management fees goes up, you can take on more debt at a management company. We have seen clients of ours use that quite successfully, where they transition over a period of time, ownership of the firm, you know, so there's a little bit of value taken out over a number of fundraisers. The other options, you know, if we start with perhaps GP stakes and people buying that, that is a big cash event. You know, it's a one-hit cash event. If you, you know, depending on what you're using the cash for, some of it can go out, but it might be used to, you know, expand strategies. You might want to do in different asset classes, debt or something like that. Some of the pitfalls with that, though, are if it's a pure cash out, it can have a detriment effect on the culture of the firm for people who've left, you know, that are left behind, because you're effectively left with, you know, a different owner, you know, than what was there before. You know, and you're seeing some of the senior people leave or take money off the table and leave you with a quite a different setup to what it was before. You know, having a sort of a non-human partner in there, shall we say, in terms of more of a corporate, just comes with different challenges in terms of how you operate your business. If you then look at all the public market options, yeah, and that can be anything from IPOs to more corporate style bonds. The issue with these is, like, private, particularly in the mid-market, private equity firms are private. You know, it's in the title. They're not set up to necessarily, you know, in terms of regulation or reporting requirements, to, you know, really sort of, you know, tap into the public markets unless they get to a certain size, you know, which we've seen, which comes with growth. But culturally, that's quite different in terms of disclosure. You know, disclosing to the stock exchange, it's you know, regulatory, the regulatory environment increases multiple times for that. And as I said before, they're private, you know, so that is a big culture change. But, you know, we've seen that done with a number of firms quite successfully. You know, if you really want to, if it's about growth and access to public markets, that is probably where you're going to get your most amount of cash, you know, so probably ticks the box in terms of people getting some value off the table. It ticks the box in terms of having cash, more cash to invest into different strategies and grow. And equally, it ticks the box in terms of, you know, from the founder-led culture. If the founders want to leave behind a brand, you know, then this is the way that you go, you know, because people are starting to invest in that brand as the firm grows rather than a core set of individuals.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there are questions with each of these options that we maybe don't have time to get into kind of in depth today, but around LP alignment as well, you know, whether they're happy with there being a kind of external potential majority owner in some of these kind of more straightforward M&A type deals, whether they're happy with what's happening to the management fees in an IPO situation, and equally in a kind of GP stakes situation as well. So that's something that we're definitely always kind of interested in monitoring, kind of gauging the temperature of the market on.
Yeah, I think there's always a lot of people to please, and, you know, it's always difficult to keep everybody happy. But, you know, I think some of the concerns that you know, I've talked about in terms of the culture of the firm and the partners that are left behind, particularly if it's a GP stakes part acquisition, would play out into LPs' minds as well. You know, if LPs are investing around a core team of people and some of those people are perhaps taking cash out, less motivated, then, you know, that's going to affect your view on, in terms of investing in the next fund and so on. So, you know, obviously all of these things will be done in full disclosure with LPs and things like that. But, you know, it can come with challenges around how the firm continues.
Definitely. And I was interested to see in InvestEx private equity trend survey, which I think was published in January. There was a lot in there, but on this kind of topic around succession that we're talking about, I think the report said that 17% of the GPs surveyed didn't know how they would finance the GP commitment for their next fund. So I'm, you know, interested to hear from you on that bit, John. Has that always been the case, that this kind of portion typically don't know, and how, you know, thinking about some of the options we've talked about, how does the way a GP chooses to finance that commitment affect succession and potentially culture?
Yeah, I think, look, PE practitioners are generally quite confident, I would say. So the 17% in this year's survey that don't know how they're going to finance their future commitments to fund is actually fairly consistent over the years. I think the difference at the moment is we've had a change in environment. You know, last year was quite a transformational year for PE in terms of, you know, got high interest rates. You know, we've had a high inflation environment. We've seen fundraising slow down massively and exits, you know, equally dry up as a result. So not knowing where you're going to get the money from at the moment is probably based on looking back into the past and thinking, well, we always make exits, I'll get carry, and therefore, you know, I'll be able to invest into my new fund in no time at all. That's not the case anymore. Equally, you know, financing of the GP commitments, which we do quite a lot of actually by some of the debt solutions that I've described earlier, there's an additional cost to that now, you know, because rates have gone up. You know, and people would often look at this as an option so that they've got money to commit to the next fund, or they would look at their own personal sort of finance and often, you know, take money out on the mortgage or whatever it may be. But all of this now costs a lot more, you know, so you've got a challenge really in terms of that the overall cost, if you need to have finance to help with your GP commit, has gone up. So people would take a view on that. We've also got the added complication that as exits have stopped, people have thought of other ways to, you know, generate liquidity, particularly for continuation vehicles. This is good for generating money for LPs and, you know, some of the GPs as well, but it means you've got to commit to the continuation vehicle as well. Yeah. You know, so you're actually just really increasing your commitments because the new fund will come around eventually. You know, it's just a bit slower. So really we're doubling down on the problem. So it is a bit surprising this year, 17%. Don't know how they're going to finance it, but that, you know, some of the options we've talked about here, you know, in terms of GP stakes in particular, you know, not all of these GP stakes deals are used as a cash out. You know, they're used as growth and, you know, cash in and helping the GP. If they own part of the GP and they've got a large balance sheet, that helps with future commitments as well. So it can be quite positive in that regard.
Yeah. And I suppose some of these deals we've seen, you know, the IK Wendell deal, for example, my colleague Min Ho, you know, reported on that, interviewed the kind of participants in the deal. And that idea of having permanent capital is really important, I think, because obviously it solves some of the problems around the GP commitment and can give a bit more security as well.
Yeah. And it gives you the option to, you know, expand, become a bigger brand. You don't just have to do private equity. Potentially you can use that to invest in, you know, buy an infrastructure team or maybe a credit team. You know, depends on your view. If you want to be a more multi-asset manager, then this provides you with some great options for the future because, you know, you need the capital injection.
Yeah, definitely. And that does very much seem to be the way, you know, large parts of the industry are going, especially kind of on the larger end with these acquisitions. And, you know, our listeners will be aware of all the activity that's been happening in the infrastructure space this year already. And, you know, in previous years, there was a bit more on the kind of, you know, buying secondaries houses side. So, you know, the question is always kind of where is it going to happen next? But obviously the kind of, you know, succession and culture and just the financing for those deals needs to be worked out and aligned for those to be successful, I suppose.
Yeah, completely. I think a lot of it, you know, and it has become more prominent in the mid-market over the last few years for, you know, well, just 3 to 5 years, I guess, because funds, you know, it's been a good time for PE. Funds have got bigger. You know, so how do you grow? Just the actual commitments in terms of actual numbers have just, you know, stayed the same. 2%, people normally put in more than 2% anyway, but the actual quantum has just got much, much bigger. And, you know, where it depends where you want to go in the future, but a lot of these options are probably quite applicable if you're growing, you know, and you're going to have to make future commitments because you can't rely on some of the things we've relied on in the last 10 years in terms of lots of exits and, you know, everyone coming through to carry quite quickly.
Yeah. And the exit issue is, you know, tricky, even if people are choosing to raise fairly flat funds of a similar size to what they may have raised, you know, 3 years ago or so, you know, if there's been a lack of exits, then financing that commitment is still harder. So it's all very much kind of interlinked.
It is. It's definitely all interlinked at the moment. I think the good news is that, you know, investors, LPs have over-allocated to PE, and that's a sign of the industry doing very, very well. Yeah, the issue now is that they want some money back to be able to reinvest again. So it's not necessarily negative news. The industry is growing, but you know, it's a circle of liquidity that's required for to keep the wheels going. People need exits so they get money back so they can reinvest in another fund, and that's the same for the GPs. You know, if the LPs are struggling, you know, in terms of saying, well, we would like some liquidity, it's exactly the same for the GPs to invest in a new fund.
Exactly. And maybe just kind of rounding this off, John, I wanted to ask you just overall what you think GPs kind of need to bear in mind when they're kind of considering and coordinating their succession. And, you know, we've talked about the kind of the higher cost of capital environment, liquidity pressure from LPs, you know, the fact that the number of exits is obviously lower, you know, it's fairly low in 2023. And at the same time, the industry is growing. So there's a need for more kind of distinction between managers. It's harder to stand out perhaps. So bearing all of that in mind, I'd be interested to hear what you think people should essentially be prioritizing and be thinking about when some of these questions around succession come up.
I think where we've seen it done well, you know, and successfully, is where the senior management team and the senior partners want to leave some sort of legacy behind, you know, and they're very focused on what is that going to be, you know, and normally that's turning the firm or creating a brand that people will invest in the brand. If you get that right and you get the transition of ownership right over a number of years, culturally that motivates the junior partners as well, because they're not just buying into three or four senior partners that do all the deal. Investors are then investing it as a brand, not around individuals. You know, so if you can create a brand that's known for its type of investments, where it invests, and transition senior, you know, senior partners out over a number of years, that creates sort of enduring legacy for me. You know, you can see it with a few firms that have done it. It helps motivate people that want to stay there. You know, if you go to the polar opposite of that, of just a cash out, that's not a great motivational factor for a lot of people wanting to stay. So we have seen a few firms do this very, very well over a number of years. And you can see it in terms of the way they present themselves. They've moved away from, here are our three core individuals that we're doing deals. And it's very much around what the brand, what they stand for, ESG policies, you know, the areas they invest in. That's where you can see transition happen really, really well.
Food for thought for some of our listeners, I imagine. And thank you, John, for taking the time to speak to me. It's been great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thanks again to John for taking the time to speak to me. Leading on from that, I think it was clear from that conversation just how important succession is for the future growth of any private equity firm. It's a topic that's very linked to this concept of PE firms transforming into multi-strategy asset managers, often looking to provide equity or other forms of financing at various parts of the capital structure. And I think it's clear that when it's managed well, we're not looking at a kind of HBO succession style chaos playing out, but a much smoother transition that sets up the PE firm for a kind of secure future and sets it up as a business for the future.
Yeah, no, I think that's such a good point. And so to just put that in context, let's talk briefly about where there hasn't been a great example of succession. And that is Carlyle. This has all been very publicly reported in the media, but Kyu-Sung Lee very abruptly resigned in August 2022, with the FT reporting that this was due to a disagreement over his pay package. And ever since then, his successor, Harvey Schwartz, has had to deal with a lackluster fundraising environment. It closed its eighth fund around $7 billion under target in October last year. But as revealed in a recent investor call, it does have a credit fund and a PE secondaries fund in the market. So let's see where that goes. But all of this has meant that Carlyle has had to be very visible on the circuit. It's, you know, it's pulled out some publicity stunts, going as far as David Rubenstein interviewing Kim Kardashian about her private equity firm at Super Return last year, which I will take any opportunity to talk about. So it's really clear just how much culture, brand, and succession are all intertwined together.
Definitely. And it matters for, you know, any kind of stakeholder in the firm, anyone that does business with the firm. And obviously the point about LPs came up a couple of times in our interview, or in the interview with John. But going back to that point again about growth, how would you say, you know, are there current examples of how we're seeing monetization routes kind of feeding into growth for GPs?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, succession where it is monetized kind of goes down two very important paths. It is, as John said, very important for the founders to be able to take some money off the table and realize some of the value that they've created. But that also has to go hand in hand with securing the growth of the GP as well. And I think CVC is a good example of this. Everyone is waiting for their IPO, whenever that may be. And there's been lots of media reports around the outside around CVC becoming a multi-asset manager. So prior to its recent acquisition of DIF, its main strategy was private equity. And it was kind of one of the last remaining large cap GPs to do that. So that's been interesting in the run-up to IPO. There's lots of speculation that with the proceeds, there could be further acquisitions of other strategies and other managers. But there's also speculation it is a way for the founders to kind of realize that value that they have created. But as we've seen, we've talked about loads on this podcast, that kind of consolidation has typically largely been seen at the large cap level.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, John even said, you know, generally the public markets have been regarded as less kind of the domain of mid-market sponsors. But at the same time, you know, the mid-market is a large part of the PE universe, even if these firms aren't raising 20 billion euro funds. They're certainly driving a lot of deal flow and have a lot of kind of LP investment. So I suppose there are kind of other options available to them. We discussed some of them. Obviously, Investec, one of the things it specializes in is the kind of debt financing side, allowing, you know, the kind of senior stakeholders in the firm to take out some debt and therefore kind of reduce their equity exposure to the firm over time if needed, especially if it's a kind of, you know, founder-owned culture that they have at the time. What else? You know, we could talk about GP stakes a bit, I suppose. We've seen quite a few examples of those in the last year.
Yeah, I think GP stakes is a fascinating environment at the moment, as well as a means to secure succession. And it's different to a standard private equity buyout because GP stakes are a minority. But, and I think this is interesting. So GP stakes investors aren't stupid. They're not, from the conversations I've had anyway, they're not the kinds of investors who want to go in and invest in a GP that doesn't have a clear plan laid out for the course of its investment, at least. So, and they tend to be a little bit longer as well, beyond the kind of typical private equity holding plan. So where a GP stake investor has come in, those I've spoken to have told me that they need to see a clear succession plan. And I don't think GP stakes should be seen as a bad thing in terms of the founders and the management taking money off the table and perhaps being less committed to the company. I mean, private equity rarely worries about this themselves with the companies that they invest in. The management teams of their portfolio companies often take some cash out when the company goes through a buyout or a monetization event. And the fund is rarely worried about the alignment of the management teams. They just want to invest in good management teams. And I think that is typically largely what the GP stakes universe is. And as we've seen, is a lot more open to the mid-market. And we've seen quite a few deals in the space.
No, that's a really good point. I think, you know, they obviously do their due diligence ahead of investing. And we typically see kind of hints of future growth plans when we get the kind of public announcements of these firms getting kind of GP stakes in them, including people like Sonova and Inflection. So yeah, there's, you know, clearly plenty of options available for the mid-market as well.
One thing I would like to say actually in all of this is, you know, we talk about succession making it sound easy. It's not. It's about making sure that there's clear paths all the way from the junior level of a GP in terms of bringing people up through the company. And I can't remember if we've spoken about this before on this podcast, but, you know, recruitment, retention is very important in the GP as it is with their portfolio companies as well. So it's stuff like giving junior staff access to carry a little bit earlier or making it easier to buy in, as was mentioned in the podcast as well.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point, because again, it's part of kind of ensuring alignment and hoping that people will kind of stick with the firm for the long term and building that culture. Yeah, as we know, it can be very difficult to hire in the PE space. So it's a big question. And yeah, one I think is definitely worth raising. I think we will wrap things up there. So thank you, Rachel, for joining the podcast again. It's been great to hear your thoughts on this.
Thank you very much, Harriet.
And thank you again, of course, to John Harvey from Investec for taking the time to speak to me. And thank you, listener, for tuning in. If you like the podcast, then please don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll see you again in the next episode.